Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Bring in show music, please.
Hi, I'm CNBC producer Katie Kramer. Today on Squawk Pod, Ron Barron, the billionaire investor who has seen it all.
And people were really upset about inflation, interest rates. That was when I started Barron Capital, 1982. 800 on the Dow Jones, now 32,000.
He says he's seen enough to know now is the time, a once-in-a-generation moment to invest.
Everything doubles in price every 14 or 15 years. Your house, your tuition, your car. If you go back to the time of Jesus Christ, from zero to 1500, the economy doubled and the number of people doubled.
Barron on what he's buying and getting past the bumps in the road.
Every time, every single time, there's been a financial panic, there's been a war, there's been a COVID chaos. Whenever these sort of things happen, the government steps in every democracy that's ever existed, and devalues our currency.
Plus, Joe, Becky, and Andrew on resurfacing those bumpy roads.
For a decade, since 2008, we've been talking about this exact conversation.
As the economy hits a policy and political inflection point.
I wish the Fed, the rest of us, didn't have to pay for bad policies.
It's Thursday, August 25th, 2022. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Andrew by in 3, 2, 1. You, Andrew.
Good morning and welcome back to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin along with Becky Quick and Joe Kernan. We got a lot going on this Thursday morning.
First up on the podcast.
Hey, folks.
The latest policy initiative of President Joe Biden's massive domestic agenda fell into place yesterday.
Here's the deal. The cost of education beyond high school has gone up significantly. The total cost to attend a public four-year university has tripled, nearly tripled in 40 years.
The president announced that he will forgive $10,000 in federal student loan debt for most borrowers. Up to $20,000 would be forgiven for recipients of Pell Grants. And about 20 million people, 45% of the Americans experiencing the financial pressure of student loan payments, would have their debt completely erased.
All this means people can start, finally crawl out from under that mountain of debt, to get on top of their rent and their utilities, to finally think about buying a home or starting a family or starting a business. And by the way, when this happens, the whole economy is better off.
This unprecedented action by the White House, wiping out hundreds of billions of dollars in consumer debt, follows years of advocacy pressure in the Democratic Party. Calls for large-scale student loan forgiveness date back to the Occupy Wall Street movement in 2011. Then advocates wondered why corporations received a bailout in the great financial crisis on their debt, and everyday Americans just seeking an education were left to figure things out themselves. Now, critics say that debt forgiveness is a terrible move. It sets an awful precedent and offers a moral hazard to taxpayers. The ones who will have to pay for this write-off aren't the ones racking up high loan balances. Maybe they didn't get to college, or they paid off their own debts. This question of hazard and how to do the right thing leads me to our next headline today. The mystery befuddling economists and those of us who work on Squawk Box for essentially this whole summer of 2022, is the U.S. economy stable, in the right place? Or are we teetering on the edge of something dark and damaging, emerging from a pandemic right into a recession? Record high inflation, a rate of price hikes not seen since the early 1980s, has impacted economic growth. In fact, two quarters of economic contraction and inflation are some of the conventional warning signs of a recession. So, conventionally, the Federal Reserve has started to hike interest rates. The benchmark federal funds rate went from 0.08% in March, pretty low, to 2.33% today. But inflation in July was at 8.5%. So, that's a big gap. Maybe the conventional wisdom doesn't apply. And that's where Joe Kernan started things off today.
Can I just, I was I was stimulated this morning. I know that's probably TMI, but
goodness.
I
want
to. No, I was by this
article. I'm getting
article.
Coffee. I'm getting coffee
by,
here.
By this article, and I think we should assign it as reading because it just got me thinking. Nobody knows how interest rates affect inflation, and it's by a guy from that is at the Hoover Institute at Stanford and Cato. But in reading it, it really made me think how much we really do know about the relationship between interest rates and inflation, and there's a whole new sort of a thesis that the economy, unlike what the Fed thinks, the Fed assumes it's inherently unstable, but that it actually is fairly stable and self-correcting. And over time, I don't know how much credence to put in this, but it even makes the case that back in the Volcker days, that if it would eventually have returned to more equilibrium, given even if we hadn't gotten a 20% interest rate.
But now the Fed should slow down.
Well, it plays into the whole notion that at best, it's a blunt instrument.
We knew this.
But at worst, it might not even be as effective as the Fed thinks.
But what about all the calls for so long for the Fed to raise rates, that they were being too easy?
I know.
That they were inflating things.
Well, what I see is that when the Fed keeps rates low, it allows our policymakers to think that money's free, and then they go crazy, and the
right,
Fed sort of
the Fed enables
trillions of dollars.
For a decade, since 2008, we've been talking about this exact conversation.
Right, there is something to the notion. If you just print, I mean, we've seen it with wheelbarrows, and we've seen it in Zimbabwe.
Helicopters.
With helicopter money. So we know that if you devalue a currency and just print too much of it.
Low rates is one thing, printing money another. Is that the lesson that we take out of this?
Wouldn't it be perfect if we just wouldn't print that much, but we would keep rates low?
But that's an argument for the Fed to keep reining in liquidity and keep bringing down the balance sheet. We're talking about two things. They have two tools. Right. One's the balance sheet. One is interest rates. The balance sheet, we still don't know what happened because we've inflated it beyond any level we've ever seen before.
But
we don't know what the outcome is.
I guess I finally decided I don't want to start anything, Andrew, but I think I just decided that I wish the Fed, the rest of us, didn't have to pay for bad policies that I think that we've seen. So now we're going to kill the economy because we've done all these stupid things in terms of spending too much money. And I know people say, well, what about the tax cuts? And I hear that, and you know, it's not just this administration, but we've really kicked it into a whole new level, especially we haven't talked about the student loan yet. That's going to be
The last two administrations.
This is a half a trillion for starters. We just did CHIPS and inflation reduction. Now, supposedly, if you believe the Inflation Reduction Act would have cut the deficit by $300 billion, this just wipes that out. And adds another $300 billion. Andrew, what we can also talk about, and I'm addressing Andrew again, because talking about bailouts and the notion that, well, we bail out companies, we don't bail out people that borrow money for something very worthy, which, you know, theoretically going to cost. I'm not sure that holds true either, because if it was systemic back in 2008, it wasn't because you were trying to put in moral hazard. It's just something that you had to hold your nose that you were doing, and it wasn't good then, and it's not good now. It's not good in either case, right?
I think it's probably not good in either case. I think we all actually, all three of us, maybe it's not fun for cable, agree about this. I think we're all on the same side on the student loan piece of this. The only thing I'd say, and as I was watching President Biden yesterday, he made a comment about, you know, someone asked him, you know, do you think this is fair? What about all the people who've spent all this money and did all the right things? You saw that, and he sort of turned around and he said, well, but what about all of these, you know, billionaires who run companies who have these, you know, other tax policies?
The president, is this unfair to people who paid their student loans or chose not to take out loans?
Is it fair to people who, in fact, do not own multi-billion dollar businesses that see why these guys give them all the tax breaks? Is that fair? What do you think?
And I thought to myself, well, that's kind of a ridiculous thing to say. But I also, I mean, ridiculous insofar as, you know, that's not the retort. We should be looking at just the merits of the tax policy in each case. But I also understood at the same time, I think for somebody like him, he's thinking of this sort of cosmic sense of justice, which is to say that our tax system, unfortunately, is so backwards. We have given so many different benefits to so many different either companies or people along the way. You've seen it even in the last 2 or 3 years during COVID. By the way, you probably saw the story about some of the celebrities who took all that PPP money. I mean, there's just been there's been so many different benefits that have been handed to different people for different reasons. And I'm not saying this is the right reason or the wrong reason, but I do think that we probably do have to think about it in this larger, you know, it's very hard because I think I don't want to say we're micro, but I think we look at the merits of the actual policy and go, this doesn't make sense, this makes sense.
I agree with you on this, too.
Well, I'm definitely much more cynical about this. To me, he cannot say no to the progressive wing of his party.
He cannot say no
to them.
It doesn't fix any of the underlying problems with the higher education system. I mean,
And it's November's coming. It's just before winter.
I get all of it. I also think that we look
at sense of fairness. Joe Biden's not thinking of a cosmic sense of fairness.
I actually agree with Andrew.
He's selling it that way. The people who wrote what he said yesterday are selling it that way, but they represent the progressive wing of the party. I think in a cosmic sense of fairness
or justice or who knows what, I think that there are people in this country, again, and they look and they say, we've incentivized or we've privileged certain people over other people. And maybe, you know, people who tried to go to college and have had a tough time, maybe they deserve something. So I get that.
What about the people who didn't go to college because they couldn't afford it? Who are now going to be asked to pay?
That's the first thing that they read. Plumbers and FedEx guys are paying for Harvard graduate degrees.
But that's why all of these policies, we've created these sort of almost industrialized policies around,
and we use the tax code
to express what we think is our democracy. And that's why this is always such a big issue.
I agree. I mean, like, I think you're right. We're all kind of on the same page. We're all flummoxed by this.
Well, I'm not ready
not
to
sure
say
how
that.
To figure it out.
But we started, I did this. It was 6:05.
We're way over.
Cheese will be next.
Coming up, legendary investor Ron Barron has been loading up on stocks. The billionaire and noted Tesla bull tells us why he's an optimistic buyer.
Everyone is so short term. Everything is so short term. So Elon Musk says that the people who are most likely to be successful are the people who have long termism.
Squawk Pod will be right back.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Tractor Supply trusts 5G solutions from T-Mobile. Together, we're connecting over 2,200 stores with 5G business internet, empowering AI so team members can match shoppers with the products they need faster. This is enriching customer experience. This is Tractor Supply with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to Squawk Pod. I'm producer Katie Kramer. We have an extended interview today with investor Ron Barron. His Barron Funds has nearly $42 billion in assets under management. About 11% of the firm's assets are in Tesla stock. Barron is a huge Elon Musk bull, investing in two Musk-founded companies, Tesla and SpaceX, and he offered financing for Musk's dramatic bid earlier this year to buy Twitter. Ron Barron is a believer in long-term opportunity. And in fact, he thinks that the volatile markets of this year offer an opportunity not seen in decades. This is on Squawk Box on June 17th, the day after the recent bottom for the S&P 500.
We heard from billionaire investor Ron Barron early this morning, and he has a message for CNBC viewers. He wrote an email to Joe and I in which he writes, "This is a huge once-in-a-generation buying opportunity. Huge, monstrous opportunity following June 2022, June 2020 as well crash."
So what does this famous buy and hold and hold and hold investor think today? I'll hand it off here to Becky Quick.
Ron, we've been talking an awful lot about where the market stands right now, where things are headed. And I just want to point out, you did make a call back on June 17th that you said this was a once-in-a-generation buying opportunity. If we can take a look at the chart of the S&P since that moment, I mean, it bottomed on June 16th. You were right. Stocks have come up significantly since then. Just wonder what you're thinking at this point. Was that the bottom?
So first of all, the market was going down significantly for 8 or 9 months when we spoke on June 17th. And at that time, virtually everyone you had on was saying negative things. And the concern was universal about inflation and higher interest rates and oil prices. And I want to point out that every time everyone tries to predict macro, they're almost always wrong. And from going back to Greenspan in 1996, when it was when he said it was irrational exuberance, and then the stock market doubled the next 4 or 5 years, or the executive you had on predicting oil prices, when oil prices, this summer he said oil prices, and he should know, he's the head of an investment bank about oil, and oil prices were 120, he said they'd be 150 by summer, and now they're 90. Commodity prices overall, everyone was worried about them. Everything across the board is down 30 or 40%. The economy is slower, inventories are being destocked. Economy is definitely slow. Hiring freezes are taking place, so the economy is definitely slower. So it's easy to get out of inflation, it's impossible to get out of deflation. So we never predict anything about the economy or about the stock market. Just when you look at the prices of companies that were selling in June and that are selling still now, they're prices that are unusually attractive relative to the company's opportunities long term. So I can't tell you this was the bottom. Who knows? But the bottom line is that these are all really attractive prices, really attractive times. And we've been buying then, been buying since, and buying continuously.
Just continuing that for 1 second, can I ask Becky if I could just add to that, because we do talk about it a lot. And there's been, I don't know if you saw how many people were calling for new lows all along from June 16th all the way up. Everybody we have on says we're going below 3,600 on the S&P. And I know you're not a short-term guy, and that's not what I'm looking for here. But what do you think of the notion that we had a really good bounce, but much more than most people thought, back to 4,200 or whatever you would say. Now it's being questioned again. And it almost makes me think, instead of that being a fake rally, a bull in an overall bear, I think now this might be a quick bear fake out to have people questioning whether they should be bullish. So yesterday we had a guy say, I've gone from selling strength back to buying dips. And I wonder if, I mean, that made sense to me. I don't think we see 3,600 again.
Well, you know, I've started in business in 1970. And then 1982 began Barron Capital. And at the time we had a small number of assets under management, that the Dow Jones was 800. And people were really upset about the market being, inflation, interest rates. That was when I started Barron Capital, 1982. 800 on the Dow Jones, now 32,000. But if you go back to World War I, in 1918, we had the Spanish flu. We like to call things Spanish flu, Chinese flu. We never can blame someone else all the time. But there was inflation, and we ended a war. And then the stock market, then you had the Roaring Twenties. And in 1945, you ended World War II. The next 3 years, you had inflation, higher interest rates. Debt was higher than the size of the economy and the stock market. And then we started the Marshall Plan, 1949 to 1955, the stock market tripled. Then you had 1982, of course, that was following the Vietnam War. You had a lot of inflation, high interest rates. And what happened? The Dow Jones went from 800 to 32,000. So do I tell you that the market is going to, so everyone is so short term. Everything is so short term. So Elon Musk says that the people who are most likely to be successful are the people who have long-termism, who think about things long-term, not now, and are optimistic. And then he says, and what you really need is people who have infinite time horizons, not tomorrow, not next quarter, infinite time horizons. So, he may not get to Mars, but he's certainly investing so he can, or people are planting trees, not necessarily because they're going to sit under them, but because other people will enjoy them. So I think that the idea here is that every time, every single time there's been a financial panic, there's been a war, there's been a COVID, an economic, uncertainty, chaos. Whenever these sort of things happen, the government steps in every democracy that's ever existed, and devalues our currency. And the way they do that, the reason they do it is because they want to take care of their citizens. They want to get reelected, of course. And then they want to protect them, and they want to make the economy grow faster, and then to get out of the debt. This is not unplanned, where we have this inflation now. This is planned. It's planned to make the debt worth less relative to the size of the economy and the economy to grow faster. It's a plan, and it always has been. And so what happens is we're investing in growth companies, so the growth companies are our hedge against inflation. No, we're not investing in commodities or Bitcoin or gold, or we're not doing any of that. We're just investing in companies growing more than the economy. Economy grows 6 or 7% a year, 2 or 3% real, 4 or 5% inflation. Inflation, you go back, look up in Google, go back as far as you can, and everything over my lifetime is 4 or 5% a year, not 2%. 4 or 5% a year. Government will tell you it's 2%, but it's 4 or 5%. Everything doubles in price every 14 or 15 years. Your house, your tuition, your car, everything.
Tuition doesn't matter. tuition doesn't matter anymore, Ron.
Tuition a little faster until they pay off your debts.
Yeah, tuition doesn't matter. I just don't want 1969 to 1982. There are periods like that, Ron, where we were at 1,000. I started at Merrill in 81, so we got lucky. But if you started Barron Capital in 1969, you might have been out of the business by 1982 after 1974.
Well, look, there were people I knew that left the business in 1982. But you know what? If you go back to the time of Jesus Christ, from 0 to 1500, so long term, you're right, doesn't always work. But from 0 to 1500, the economy doubled and the number of people doubled. So think about this. So I'm outside the temple walls, and I'm a money changer, and I'm trying to raise money. I go to Becky and I say, Rebecca, I think that you should let me manage money for you, and I think I can double your money over the next 1,500 years. That's what
I'm
it was,
a woman
1,500
that's 2,000 years ago, but I don't have any money.
But then you had the Industrial Revolution in 1800, and the next 200 years, the economy went up 100 times. And over the last 50 years, the growth is accelerating. And it's going to accelerate even further because now you have the digitization of everything taking place. So I am incredibly bullish for my children, for my grandchildren, and for me, next 20 years. It's not that many people who are 79 years old who are thinking about 10 and 20 year horizons, but that's what I think about.
That's fantastic. So let's talk about the stocks you're seeing right now, Ron. What are your favorite stocks that you have seen in this arena, the ones you've been buying the last couple of months?
Well, the most recent biggest purchases I've made, and people in my office are buying all the time. I tell them, you got to keep buying. So two largest investments I've made in the past couple of months are SpaceX, where we added another $100 million, and Figs, which is you haven't heard very much about, but you will soon. It's the Lululemon Healthcare, and we invested about $100 million there. But I've invested across the board in travel. I love travel. It's been deferred for 3 years. Nobody's traveled, and now the business has really taken off, and we're investing in Hyatt, we're investing in Vail, we're investing in Red Rock. So Red Rock, they have in Las Vegas, they didn't like to have casinos next to hospitals, next to schools, next to communities. And so they rewrote the legislation. And when they rewrote the legislation, the guy who owns all of the casino land that can be built in Las Vegas, other than on the strips, in the strip you build a casino, $3, $4, $5 billion, and if you make a 10% return, you're very lucky. They're building in communities $750 million for the people who work in those casinos. So that's where they go for hamburgers and pizza and movies and beer and rent hotels by the hour. I don't know. Parking. They say invest in parking lots, so it's stripes in the parking lot instead of expensive rooms. So their investment return, they invest $750 million for a casino, not $3 or $4 or $5 billion. And instead of making 8 or 9 or 10% return, they make 20. And they got exclusivity. They got the only land. So I like that. I like Vail, which is taking data, and they're making it better so they can attract people there. And they have these resorts that feed to them. Hyatt, they came to visit us about, a couple of weeks ago. And I love this guy, Mark Hoplamazian. And he was explaining how upset he was that analysts are valuing his company at 11 times for the hotels that he owns. He's selling these hotels because he's turning into a fee business and taking back management contracts. But he's selling them at 11 times. He's selling them at 17 times, and the stock market is telling everyone it's worth 11 times. Analysts are saying it's worth 11 times. They're selling them at 17 times. They're selling them, getting cash for them, and taking back management contracts. And then he's got this other business, which is managing those hotels, and that's selling 12 times, maybe 15 times. They're selling half price, and they keep buying stock. And I told him, I'm really busy right now. I can't really give him ideas about how we should present to investors, but you know, he should. I love Tesla. We've been investing in Tesla for 8 years now, since 2014. Made about 20 times our money, made about $6 or $7 billion on a $380 million investment. I think we're gonna make 3 to 5 times our money again over the next 10 years. I am so excited. The next 10 years, I think that Tesla is going to be the largest company in the world. And in the 10 years after that, I think it'll be challenged by SpaceX, which could become the largest company in the world. I was telling you about Figs.
Obviously, another Elon Musk company, SpaceX. You have investments in both.
So we own about 1% of SpaceX. We have about $1.2 billion invested. We've been investing for about 3 or 4 or 5 years. Our cost is probably $400 million. I think we're going to make 8 times the next 10 years, 8 or 10 times. And I think that the following 10 years, this can be a monster company. This is the internet for the entire world. You saw what happened in Ukraine, where Zelensky called up Elon Musk and said, hey, Elon, I don't know what he calls him, Elon or Mr. Musk. He says, we can't communicate with our troops. Can you help us? And in 48 hours, they have these satellites going around the Earth right now, 4,000 on the way, there will be 4,000 this year, on the way to 40,000 or 35,000 within 10 years. And this is the internet for the world. And that is one area for them. But then they have backhaul, which is probably, for telecom companies, probably $1 trillion. What they've done, the innovation that they've done, is that they've made it so you can reuse rockets over and over and over again. So since before him, there was no reusable rockets. You're using the same technology that you have been since the 1960s. And now all of a sudden, you can reuse these rockets. The two young women, the 40 under 40s from Lululemon, from Figs, they visited SpaceX a couple of days ago, and they were telling me that it is the coolest place they've ever seen in their life, the coolest place they've ever seen in their life. And so this is the internet for the entire world. I'm really excited about that.
Ron, let me ask you about Elon Musk and just how much he's been in the news lately, because you have been one of his biggest boosters and a longtime believer, longtime investor in his companies. You're also somebody who has agreed to do some financing if that Twitter deal goes through with Elon Musk. I think you have $100 million that you'd be on the line for financing with that. Are you in favor of that deal going through? Are you wishing that you weren't somebody who was investing $100 million at this point?
Well, he made a $7 billion so far, and on a $380 million investment. And when he explained why he thought that this was attractive, he was going on circumstances that he was led to believe that he, since his belief, he believes is now inaccurate facts. So I went to law school, and I went to law school at night. I see Andrew making opinions about this all the time. I hear hedge funds have opinions all the time. But I went to law school, and the first night, I went at night on a scholarship. I worked in the patent office in the daytime. And the first night I'm in class, I took a contracts class, and it was with a Monroe Friedman. And he hands out this book, big, thick contracts book, and it says, read these cases and come back tomorrow. We'll discuss them. 100 people in the classroom. And we go back the next day, and he says, what do you think happened here? And everybody raises their hand, and then he says, no, this is what happened. And then he asks, it shows the next case. What do you think happened? Fewer hands go up. And he says, what do you think happened? And everyone says the same thing. He says, no, that's not what happened. This is what happened. And then he asks the final one. The fewer hands still go up. And he raises his hand. And then he says, no, this is what happened, the opposite. And so what my conclusion was, after watching this and going to law school for 3.5 years, I dropped out. And I had one semester to go. And dropped out because I ran out of money and came to New York. But the conclusion I had after going to law school was that there is no law. It's just the best lawyers always win. And every case, it doesn't matter what facts you look at, every case is a toss-up. You toss up. And everything, who knows? And so I don't know who's going to win or who's going to not win. And if he wins, I'm sure there'll be some sort of settlement. Or if he actually was forced to buy it, then he would make it better than it was. But it's certainly not as valuable as he thought it was, I would assume, from what he's, you know, from the public press. But I have no inside knowledge or no insight as far as whether it's going to go through or whether it won't go through. But I'm happy to support him in almost everything he does.
Ron, it's Andrew, and you're right. We have lots of opinions about this. We debate it virtually every day. I just wanted to know from you on two fronts, and it goes to the question I think Beck was asking. Do you feel, as an investor, that you were defrauded by Twitter?
Listen, I'm not commenting on Twitter. This is not studying this. I have no opinion. Basically, I look at Tesla, and everyone talks about competition in Tesla, right? Aren't they going to be? But even my wife says to me, Ron, everyone's going to have electric cars. Of course they're going to have electric cars. There would not be any electric cars were it not for Elon Musk. None. And so what he's doing that other people can't possibly do is that he is making so he's investing now in a plant that makes 1 million cars a year, about $7 billion. Every time he puts up one of these million car plants, he's making $7 billion. It's costing him $7 billion. When they have that plant up, right, that produces 1 million cars, the gross profit per car is about $15,000. So basically, right now, so he's selling something for $50 that costs him $35. That means that every time he invests $7 billion, this is the most profitable company in the entire world. Every time he invests, right, $7 billion, he's making $15 billion a year.
Other car companies
make 10%.
And you've made an extraordinary amount of money with Elon, and maybe unto itself that is a reason to support him, in any circumstance. Having said that, I believe it's $100 million of your investors' money who've put money with you to entrust you with that money, that $100 million. And we're looking at a situation where if he's forced to buy it, I think people believe, I don't know if you believe this, that the unaffected price of Twitter today is probably half of what he paid. Now, maybe over time that changes and maybe he's able to improve it. But how, as an investor, do you think about that?
If you looked at Tesla when we started to buy it 8 years ago, it was not worth anywhere near the price that we paid if he wasn't going to grow in the future, period. It was not worth a fraction of what we paid. And the reason we bought it was because we thought, unlike most, that it was have this tremendous opportunity. And as a result of that, we thought it was going to be a different company in the future than it was at that moment. I'm sure the same thing is going to be the case with Twitter. If it is on its own, who knows how it's going to be. But if Elon Musk ran it, it would be a different company. But it's not on the basis of what it is right now. So basically, if it is what it is right now, who knows what it's going to be if he doesn't go through, because it hasn't been very well managed, that's for sure. As you can tell from a whistleblower. But let me just make one point about Tesla. So $15,000 is what, that means $15 billion a year for every time you make $7 billion investment. In addition to that, though, they just passed the IRA law, the Inflation Reduction Act, and they're doing some really interesting things here. And what they're doing is that they're saying, listen, we can't rely we made a terrible mistake in oil, and we rely on other people to provide us with this energy. And let's not make the same mistake with chips. Let's not make the same mistake with batteries. And so now they're giving people incentive to onshore and make batteries in the United States. And our guy happens to be a prime beneficiary of that. Tesla is a prime beneficiary of that. So far we made 20 times, I think we make 3 or 4 or 5 times next 10 years. On this one bill that just passed, we're going to get an incentive. Everyone who makes cells in the country is going to get an incentive of $3,500, $4,000 a car. That means that we're making $15,000 a car right now. You can add another $3,000 or $4,000 a car just because we're making the batteries here and because we're going to make more of them. Other people are going to start. We got to have batteries in the United States. In addition to that, what they do casting. So my wife says, Mercedes is going to have. Of course they're going to have these cars. Everyone's going to have electric cars, but no one's going to have the cars. I drove in a Mercedes car last night. I hated it. when an electric Mercedes, And it's just the battery's in the wrong place. The center of gravity isn't right.
I'm so sorry. Okay. They are talking us out. They let us go as long as we possibly could. Of course, we always want more with you. And of course, we hope we are going to see you again very soon. I think the headline here, Ron said back on June 17th, this was a generational opportunity to buy stocks. Thinks that's still the case, that you haven't missed out just yet. Ron Barron, we always appreciate your time, and we look forward to seeing you again soon. Thank you, Ron.
Next on Squawk Pod. Not exactly a Hollywood ending for Warner Brothers in 2022.
Shazam, the Jim Neighbors life story. No, that's not what it is.
The legendary studio delaying some high-profile movie releases.
Jim Neighbors was Gomer Pyle, and he always said Shazam.
Over my head.
Shazam, Sergeant Carter!
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. Together with Delta, we're putting 5G into the hands of ground staff so they can better assist on-the-go travelers with real-time information. From the Delta Sky Club to the Jet Bridge, this is elevating customer experience. This is Delta with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You're listening to Squawk Pod from CNBC. Here's Joe Kernan.
Warner Brothers Discovery is delaying release dates for a few high-profile movies as the company continues to cut costs following its merger. The sequel to Aquaman, Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom, I think, what's-her-face is in it?
Johnny Depp,
yeah,
Amber Heard.
Yeah, I think so. That was set to hit the big screen, but a small part.
It was brought down.
Set to hit the screen in March. Fans are now going to have to wait until Christmas Day 2023. Meantime, Shazam, the Jim Neighbors life story. No, that's not what it is. Shazam, the sequel, is being pushed to March 2023. From its original release date of this December. So, Sorkin, you're a Hollywood expert movie person. What does this mean exactly? Do the movies stink like the one he canceled? I'm talking about Zaslav again, but are they bad like the one he canceled? Does it save money to wait for the release date?
Maybe
do they tweak it? Do they make it better? Is it not a good time when they were going to release it? So it'd be a better time to release it at these new dates.
Do
you understand?
I don't know.
Maybe.
I think these are timing issues.
With other movies, you mean?
Timing up either against other movies or just thinking that there's going to be an opening in terms of seasonality. That's what I think in this case. This is unlike the other film.
Or moving
Batgirl and the others was an accounting issue. Was strictly an accounting issue.
Right, because they got a tax benefit. But how was the first Shazam?
There was a tax benefit. And now they're taking lots of other programming, for example, off of HBO Max. That's about residuals. Not having to pay residuals in the future at the same time that they're trying to declutter the service, given that there's so much clutter on those services. This, I think, is a very different thing. This is, I think, just looking at the calendar, looking at what you're up against, looking at marketing budgets, seeing what you can do. That's what I think is going on, but I don't know.
Did you see the original Aquaman?
Yes.
I like the big guy from Game of Thrones, Jason Momoa.
Oh, yeah, Momoa.
What is Shazam about? Is that a genie thing?
Yeah, Shazam goes back to the ancient, a kid gets in trouble. Shazam, you're one of ancient spirits. It reminded me of Xanadu.
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever saw Xanadu with Olivia Newton-John.
Poor Olivia. My Jim Neighbors joke, Andrew, did you understand? Gomer Pyle, Jim Neighbors was Gomer Pyle, and he always said Shazam. That was why, for every generation X.
Shazam.
Right. Shazam, Sergeant Carter. Yeah, that's why I said it was the gym name.
I know Shazam is an app that tells you what the song is.
And that is the podcast for today. Thanks so much for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern. And to get the smartest takes, analysis, interviews from our TV show right into your ears, please follow Squawk Pod. We are available for free on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, really wherever you like to listen. Have a great day, and we'll meet you right back here tomorrow.
Now we are clear. Thanks, guys.
Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.